This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on Sunday, the 8th of September 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 218 of the Monocle Weekly. With a slight turning of the presenters' tables this week, I, Tom Edwards, will be your host, and I'm joined by Monocle's Marco Sippi for the next hour here on Monocle 24.
On the show today, we'll be meeting journalist and broadcaster Tim Harford, also known as the Undercover Economist. He's here to explain the seemingly trivial transactions and tribulations that affect everyday situations and what really keeps the global economy working until it breaks.
We'll also be talking to Dr. Bates Gill, an expert on foreign policy and security in Asia and the Australasian region, about the US's shift towards Asia. We'll hear from him later.
And we'll be chatting to author John Rogers about his hometown of London's seldom seen sights and sounds. Well, they won't be undiscovered for long.
That's all coming up. Plus, I get to ask the questions about next week's news. Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be in the hot seat for that later. And we'll have some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, what a week it's been here at Midori House, Marco Sippi. Many of our colleagues, of course, spent the last few days in Berlin, didn't they?
I was just about to say that it's actually been probably the quietest week I've experienced here at Midori House. I feel like the editorial floor is pretty much half empty.
And we should perhaps explain the absence of Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. I mean, they were in Berlin for, obviously, the big launch of the Monocle book, the Monocle Guide to Better Living. I mean, you know a thing or two about Berlin, don't you? You're a bit of a fan of the city, from what I gather.
I'm a big fan of the city, yes. I'm slightly envious that I'm not there at the moment, because obviously I have my own job to do here in London, but I'll undoubtedly be heading there very soon. By the way, have you been reading the book already?
Oh, of course. I have a copy right here, Marcus, to my hand. I'll just leaf through the pages so that our listeners can get it.
Because I realise there's still something for me to learn as well, some inspirational ideas for my life, so I'm trying to improve my living.
You do have a long way to go, to be fair. Anyone who's seen you in the flesh will know that.
I'm just trying to find the right type of dog.
Well, that's important. A Shiba Ken is what I gather is important. That's all been what's been happening at Midori House. Normally at this stage of the programme, Andrew and Rob would be in the hot seats. But as we know, they're gallivanting all around the world. So it's my turn. The tables are truly turned. I can summon someone into the studio. If you will, imagine a dancing news monkey. To delve into next week's big news stories.
You are not saying that Daniel Giacopelli is coming into the studio, are you?
Marcus, that's exactly where we're going. He may be accompanied by some kind of god-awful jingle. We're joined by Monocle's resident New Yorker and roving news hound, Daniel Giacopelli. Do you feel proud of your town, Danny?
I do feel proud.
Did we make you feel welcome?
To be fair, I'm from outside of New York City, so it's a bit of a cheat, but as you said, Long Island's correct.
Well, you're being a bit picky there. I thought that was quite good. We'd gone for that
special effort. It's like if you were from Essex, you would say, you know, he's from London.
I want to do the news look ahead sometime as well, so I get this kind of a welcome.
What would the song be for Marcus?
Probably something, one of the musical favourites from Celine Jordi.
There are so many
to choose from. Or, I mean, none that I can think of right now.
I still haven't come up with my Christmas single.
There's that song from the Smurf world.
I don't know what you're talking
yes,
about, Giacopelli.
It's in Helsinki.
Oh,
you know exactly what I'm talking about.
You're talking about the Moomin world.
Yeah, all right.
That's not
the
even
Moomins,
close to where I come
very,
from.
Very, very popular, of course, in Helsinki and all around the globe. But it's time...
On to the news.
Exactly. Let's look ahead to, next week's news now. Danny, where should we start?
Tom, International Shipping Week, as you know, is next week, and I'll be going. So this is almost a week-long event that brings together the world of ship owners, insurance people, security people, pirate experts. And it's a slew of events all across London for the entire week from Monday the 9th of September to the 12th, which is Thursday.
So when it comes to people who are really excited about ships, is there anything they're looking forward to particularly much?
This is the Disney World of... this is the Davos of the Shipping Week, let's put it that way. I will be attending two events on maritime security, piracy. I'll be going to an event on the future of Somalia in terms of piracy. It's going to be held on a boat in the Thames.
What kind of boat do we know?
A beautiful boat.
Okay. I gather that's not technical, but...
It sounds like you're going to be there just holding a glass of sparkling.
I'm hoping to be doing that with naval officers and chatting about the good old days.
But this is genuinely interesting, isn't it? There's lots of important developments as well. We talked before on Monocle 24 about super tankers. You know, can the size of ships just keep getting bigger and bigger? Is this the kind of event where people try and answer those kind of questions and say, look, these are the big trends. This is what's actually going to be happening. These are the real challenges that face people out on the water day to day.
Yeah, exactly. There are hundreds of events across the city. Everybody's kind of flying in. And I'll be doing this as part of a week-long series on the world of international shipping, which will be within a month or two. We'll have that on Monocle 24. There'll be a bunch of things about technology in particular. A lot of makers of pirate detecting software and deterrence devices will be there. It's Candyland for the people who are really into this type of stuff. Next, though, Tom, New York votes for their mayor.
Now, this is an exciting race.
Very exciting race.
Is it fair to say there's colorful characters are involved, aren't they?
Yeah. So Bloomberg, we haven't had a mayor, and I say we, my fellow New Yorkers haven't had a new mayor in about 12 years. So doesn't come around often. Well, it does come around often, but Bloomberg just kind of scooped them up the last 3 times. Interesting characters. The race has been wild so far. There've been 3 different front runners in as many months. Right now, Bill de Blasio, who's the public advocate of the city, is ahead. As you know, Anthony Weiner was once the front runner. He's still in the race, actually.
So he's still got his hat in the ring.
Yeah, if you look at pictures of debates, he's kind of hanging out there on the left side, like I haven't texting heard of his friends, his girlfriends.
Yeah, exactly. I was just asking you, is the reason why I haven't heard from him lately that he's actually being a bit lazy with texting?
He's been a bit lazy. Yeah, there was a video that emerged yesterday, 3 days ago, rather, of him doing a Jamaican accent at a festival for Caribbean people in the city, and it's a bit racist.
He's trying to set some kind of world record for marginalizing every single different community.
He's trying to offend everybody. Well, as you know, he offended the British people a couple of weeks ago when he mocked that, I think it was a Sky News reporter or someone from British television channel, and he did a faux British accent. Yeah, he's been very consistently
offending everybody.
Offensive.
It sounds like he's missing some kind of an instinct to protect himself from trouble.
Well, who knows?
I'm pretty sure that he long since lost that. To be honest.
But back to the race, though. Back to the race. Christine Quinn, she would be the first woman and the first openly gay mayor of New York City if she were to win. There's John Liu, the city comptroller. Bill Thompson, former city comptroller. But it looks at the moment that Bill de Blasio may win. But then again,
is that the Danny Jacopelli verdict?
That's the Quinnipiac poll verdict.
That's what the pollsters are telling you.
How much has he promised already?
You know, I don't know what he's promised so far. They all promise everything and they don't deliver. I mean, the issues involved are public housing, schools, stop and frisk, which is this controversial policing law. But, you know, who knows?
Well, we'll await with interest. Booker Prize shortlist. This is always exciting for sort of fans of the literary dimension. This is happening on Tuesday, is that right?
Yes, Tuesday. It's the shortlist will be revealed. The long list has been around. But as you know, the Man Booker Prize, it promotes the best books in the English language, written by someone from the Commonwealth of Nations, Zimbabwe, also in Ireland. Last year, Hilary Mantel won for her book, Bring Up the Bodies. This year, there's a good roster of potential authors that could win. So literary aficionados will be watching carefully.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because Hilary Mantel attracted some sort of adverse publicity because she was so sort of widely lauded. She was back to win every prize going. She did end up winning most of them. Do you think that they'll be a bit more circumspect this time and try and be a bit more sort of literary and not go deliberately trying to avoid being accused of going for the populist choice?
Perhaps. I mean, the books in the shortlist aren't as many standout novels that everybody would know. For instance, like Hilary Mantel everybody bought her book even before. I mean, she was famous even before she won, obviously. So it's hard to tell now. What is known, though, that whoever does win will surely have a huge rise in sales because that always happens. I mean, this is kind of the publishing world looks to this because they know that they're going to have at least a modest uptick in sales of the book of the author who won.
Well, thank you very much for that, Danny. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly and we'll be speaking to the undercover economist after this.
Now, Tim Harford is a journalist, author and broadcaster whose love of the surreal quirks of the financial world, condensed into entertaining, understandable plain speak, have made him the go-to economist for people who, well, don't really like economics.
Going under the moniker the undercover economist, his skills are in demand from everyone from the Financial Times to the BBC and TED Talks, and his new book, The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, looks at everything from prison life economics to the price of a bottle of Coke.
So, Tim, welcome to Monocle 24. Thanks for coming to speak to us. We're talking about Undercover Economist Strikes Back. And I wonder...
Can we play the Darth Vader theme at this point?
I think we should definitely play that, okay, just to get some mood music. Given the success of the first instalment, did it change your sort of writerly attitude? Because I guess people's expectations maybe change, the sort of things that people say to you, the way people even talk to you about economics maybe changes. Did you find that you had to change your mindset because of how well the first instalment did?
Not because of how well the first instalment did. I mean, this is my fifth book, depending on how you count them, and the experience of writing each one has been different, and I haven't particularly felt that difficult second album syndrome. I love writing books, so it doesn't worry me. But writing about macroeconomics did pose a problem. So P.G. O'Rourke once said that microeconomics is economists being wrong about specific things and macroeconomics is economists being wrong about things in general. The first book was micro, and what that meant was I could walk into Starbucks, look at the prices at Starbucks and say, there's something interesting here. Let me tell you what's interesting. Let me tell you what I see as an economist that you might not have noticed. And you could constantly point to specific things in the world around you. Now, macroeconomics is about the system, really. It's about all the things people think of as being economics: inflation, unemployment, deficit, austerity, all of that. But if you point to any one thing, the risk is that you're missing something really important and systemic that's going on behind your back. So that was the challenge I was wrestling with, how to talk about this systemic aspect without making it terribly boring or terribly abstract. So that was what I was trying to do.
And about microeconomics, it's actually quite easy to point out individual things, whereas macroeconomics is about wider themes. How much did you think about the approach, how to make things understandable to the reader? Because what I really like about this book is that I actually do understand it without having to.
And that's a real triumph if that happens.
You're a man of taste. Thank you very much. I thought about it quite a lot. And I think there are two key things that I did. One was, and this wasn't the way I originally planned to write the book, I used a dialogue format, a Q&A, which I use in some of my columns. I mean, that sounds potentially very, very wearing if it was backwards and forwards every paragraph. And actually, I've tried to spread it out. So it's a dialogue between some slightly too smart for his own good economist and the reader. And the reader has been put in charge of some economy. The reader is the governor of the central bank or is the chancellor of the exchequer or something. It's not quite specified. But what's fun about that is the economist can sort of say, well, you know, here's why this is complicated, rah, 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 explain all this stuff. And the reader can just push back and say, well, you just contradicted what you said last chapter. Or you're sitting on the fence. So it enables me to have a little bit of fun and to explain the economics, but also to sort of puncture some of the pomposity or to challenge. That was one thing. The second thing I did was I really wanted to find, because macroeconomics is about systems, where can I find systems, economic systems that are simple enough that you can describe them, no maths, no, none of this sort of jargon, and you can see the whole system working. And I found two. So one is really quite famous. Paul Krugman has written about it a lot, which is the Capitol Hill babysitting co-op. It was originally written about not by Krugman, but Krugman made it famous. And this babysitting co-op had a classic Keynesian recession or depression almost in the 1970s. So I write about that. And it was fixed by money printing. But I found another, and I was quite pleased with the other example, which is a prison camp in the Second World War. One of the prisoners of war was an economist called Robert Radford. And when he got out, he wrote about it almost immediately and was published in a peer-reviewed academic journal. And the prison camp had its own economy. It had supply, it had demand. They were even at one point exporting coffee into Munich because the Red Cross parcels that were coming into the prison camp had coffee and people in Munich didn't have coffee. So there were all kinds of things going on. But the prison camp also suffered a very severe recession. And it was not a Keynesian recession at all. It was a classical recession. So with these two examples, I was able to point out all of the things that economists are arguing about all the time about the austerity agenda can be summarized. Are we really talking about a babysitting co-op recession, or are we talking about a prisoner of war camp recession?
And then once your readers are sort of empowered by this information, it's quite interesting because you sort of talk obviously a lot, the whole background to, you know, post-2008 and all these crises around the world. Do you think that, would you like to think, I guess, that a reader who'd read your book and posed these questions to you, sort of metaphorically, and then to themselves, would they do a better job, do you think, than any of our current crop of global economic so-called experts?
I would like to think they could probably do a better job than the politicians. I mean, I have a lot of respect for the central bank governors that we have. They get a lot of flack. Mervyn King, Mark Carney, Ben Bernanke. I mean, these are smart people doing very, very difficult jobs. Politicians, well, they may be smart, but they have other objectives other than running the economy well. They're very interested in politics, of course. So I would have thought that a reader could potentially do a better job.
I have to ask this. Do I dare to ask for a name and shame list of the countries that have been worst managed?
Gosh, there's so many choices. I've been very disappointed with George Osborne, I have to say. And it's not a political book, and I'm not really interested in pointing the finger at individual politicians, but I was really hopeful when the Conservatives were elected, sort of elected with the support of the Dems.
let's not get bogged down in that detail now.
That they were going to be able to introduce the reforms that were needed in a very difficult time. And I think George Osborne he's cut the wrong spending at the wrong time. He's raised taxes too early. I mean, I don't think that we would be in a radically better position if Ed Balls had been in charge. But I do think we would have been in a somewhat better position. But I mean, it's hard. Running an economy is really hard. So if you look at India, for instance. India has been suffering recently, and there's a sort of classic pattern. Every economy has its own specific problems, but the basic problems are often driven by politics. So India's problem, in a nutshell, they had a big boom. They had from 2003 to 2008 to do all kinds of difficult reforms that would have really, really helped. And they didn't, because no one felt any pressure. And now the politicians are trying to introduce the reforms in an extremely difficult circumstance. There's a line in the book where I say, what you really need to be is a tough bastard right winger during a boom. And actually, during booms, we often elect left wingers to hand out the money. And then during a recession, you want to be a bleeding heart left winger. But actually, during recessions, we tend to elect the tough bastards. And that's completely the wrong way around, sadly.
That's interesting stuff. Now, at the end of the book, you have this point about, we actually make this analogy with the famous shaking bridge here in London, which was, you know, beautifully designed, supposedly very well executed, but unforeseen problems, usually to do with people and the way they behave, can cause these things to sort of slightly unwind. And you sort of make that comparison with, you know, economics, macroeconomics, that, you know, for all the great theorising, you mentioned these great minds in the central banks. Is there not a sense to which you never can really quite prepare for everything? You can never foresee everything. You can never plan for these kind of eventualities. Isn't there always a risk? And so some people, cynics maybe you might call them, would say, well, it's all well and good with the theory. You know, you've answered a lot of the questions and very well. Even you can't be sure what's going to be around the next corner.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think you've got to have a tremendous amount of humility when you're dealing with any complex system. My previous book, if I may be allowed a plug, my previous book, Adapt, is all about success is down to fixing mistakes quickly rather than getting it right first time. I mean, it's obviously nice to get things right first time, but you never will. So spot the error, fix the error. And Adapt was all about the organizational behavior and the psychology of that. Can we talk about the walkie scorchy for a moment?
Absolutely.
So as loyal listeners may be aware, London's newest skyscraper is melting nearby cars reportedly and setting fire to things. And it's because it has this concave shape. Is it concave or convex? I can never remember. It has this
I think it's concave. I'll go for that.
You are the native speaker.
It has this shape that focuses sunlight, and the sun at the moment at this time of year is shining on this curved surface of this building, and it's focusing the beam, and it's like frying ants under a magnifying glass. Not that I ever used to do such a thing. Now, why do we have that problem? Is it because engineers and architects do not understand the laws of physics? Or is it because we have discovered some previously unknown law of physics? No, we knew. We understood this perfectly well. It never occurred to anybody that the laws of physics would happen to come together in this particular way. And if you look at why bridges wobble, why buildings fall down, why domes collapse, again and again, it's not that in retrospect the thing was inexplicable. In retrospect, you always know why it happened. It's just that in advance, there was some, oh, the snow will blow in at a particular angle, and no one had ever considered, our modelling didn't consider that snow would come at an angle rather than come straight down. It's the same with economics. Clearly, the laws of economics are not laws in the sense the laws of physics are. Clearly, they are less firm. Clearly, they're more contested. But a lot of the problems in the financial crisis were not all the fundamental laws of economics are wrong. They were the laws of economics applied in ways that, with hindsight, are all too predictable, but not enough people bothered to pay close attention to what might happen when bankers were signing these very strange contracts.
At the same time, before 2008, do you also have the feeling that politicians just simply didn't listen to the economists carefully enough?
No, I would love to say the economists saw it all coming and the politicians didn't listen, but no, there are certain things economists all agree on that politicians always ignore. But when it comes to the crisis, I see the crisis as largely technical. It's like a nuclear power station melts down, an oil rig blows up. These are complex systems. There's human error involved. There's bad design involved. There may be malfeasance involved. And if you want to prevent that kind of accident again, you need to reform whistleblowing. You need to make the systems more modular. There are all kinds of things you need to do. This is something I discussed in my last book. I don't think that economists were paying enough attention to the details of banking. It wasn't that economics was intellectually bankrupt. There were details. They mattered. Too few of us were paying attention. And not just economists, the lawyers, the accountants, etc. But I don't think it's just, if only they had listened to us, these problems would have been prevented. That's not true.
Interesting stuff. Tim Harford, thanks very much for coming to talk to us. I just wanted to end by saying, undercover economist, how much longer can you retain your undercover status? Are you not at risk? Everything's going too well for you. People have wised up, haven't they?
No one has yet unmasked me. I think my secret is safe.
And for the whole duration of this interview, I've been trying to remember what happened after Empire Strikes Back. What was the sequel?
Return of the Jedi. It's best forgotten. That was the beginning of the end for the Star Wars films, I'm afraid. There'll be no Ewoks if I write a third book, I promise you.
I would love to know who the global economic Ewoks are.
But could I remind you that The Empire Strikes Back was the best film? And there you go, I'm just saying.
Yeah, Brooks, no argument here. Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Monocle Weekly. We're going to be discussing Australia, the US and Asia, and how they all do or don't get along just after this. But let's have some music. This is Washed Out with All I Know from their new album, Paracosm.
That was Watched Out with All I Know, new music from the recent album Paracosm. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly.
And up next, I'm going to be chatting with Dr. Bates Gill. Stay tuned.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibaken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Marco Sippi. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, as it's known around the world, has been a centre of inspiration and practical resources for public policymakers worldwide since the 1960s. Dr. Bates Gill was its director for the past 5 years, but last year took a new position, a CEO of the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
Gill's new Australian home and years of expertise as a political analyst studying peacekeeping and security issues across the globe, especially in Asia, puts him in an ideal place to comment on the US's ongoing focal shift in foreign policy to the Asia region. He stopped by Midori House a little earlier to talk to Tom about foreign policy's opening frontier.
Bates, welcome to Monocle 24. Thanks very much for coming to chat with us.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks.
I guess the first thing to just start by asking you about how you've settled in your new role, other side of the world from where you were before. And I think perhaps when we last heard from you on Monocle 24, you were at SIPRI still. So, tell us what you're up to and how you've settled in.
Yeah, it's been a big change. About a year ago, I moved to Sydney. And, from Stockholm to Sydney was a nice shift, two beautiful cities. But Sydney's been spectacular. The job there is going very well. We found a nice spot on the water, on the harbour, and we're loving it.
Great stuff. Now, it's interesting, I think, to consider the sort of the attitude in Australia towards the US and the understanding of how the US engages with not just Australia, but all throughout the region and into East Asia. What were you sort of expecting to find when you took up the job as the chief executive at the US Studies Centre? Did you think that, were you expecting any sort of surprises in terms of how people, certainly in Australia and throughout the wider region, expected US engagement with them to change shape over the next few years?
Well, I think one of the great things about being there is that it is, on the rim of the Asia Pacific. And so for me, it's a great opportunity to sort of get back to my roots and be closely following developments in this very dynamic part of the world. I'm actually am surprised that the depth and breadth of sort of appreciation and understanding about the United States, or I should say an interest in the United States. A part of our job is to try and inform that interest, try to make it more nuanced and aware and informed. But the depth of interest is quite remarkable. There seems to be a bit of cynicism, skepticism about the United States and lots of places in the world. I don't see that quite as deep in Australia. And it's almost an appreciation, which is refreshing.
It's really interesting. I mean, we've obviously sort of looked and talked a lot on Monocle 24 before about this sort of US pivot to Asia and this kind of broad policy change there and a preoccupation. And I guess it works across a number of different mediums. It's not just political or diplomatic. It also involves the cultural realm, the economic realm. How well positioned and how effective do you think the US is going to be at making that happen as you've moved through these different parts of the world? Do you think that there is a genuine sense of, I guess, welcoming that that's what's happening in the US? And do you think that the people actually in DC who are making these decisions really know how to effectively make that happen?
I take the policy very seriously for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think, first of all, it just makes so much obvious sense that this is the part of the world where any major country needs to be focused. And of course, it's been underway, this gradual shift of attention and resources to this part of the world by the United States and many other countries for a long time, a decade or more, obviously. And yes, the people that I know in Washington who are sort of in charge of or overseeing this take it very, very seriously. They like to remind us that this is an idea of the president's himself, and that in Washington, that means the policy will get done and will be driven forward from the very top. You know, you look across the different activities, new initiatives, placement of resources, diplomatic and financial, and you can see it really adds up to something rather serious. And I would just say that looking ahead the next couple of months, with the president traveling out to Asia later this year, we're going to see a lot of new initiatives announced, a lot of very interesting new steps, I think.
Do you feel that we've obviously seen these interesting changes at senior party level in the last sort of few months and year or so? Do you feel then more optimistic about exactly how that engagement with the US and the rest of the world will take shape over the next, say, 10 years? Do you think that does part of that optimism about how well the countries can work together come from some of the personnel changes, for example? Or do you think there are broader changes in terms of a realization about how the engagement needs to happen, how it, at the very least, needs to be perceived by the outside world in terms of how they'll move forward in the next 5-10 years?
It's still early days with the new leadership in China, but all indications suggest so far that they will not shift dramatically away from what has been, I think, the fundamental policy of the country of the past decade or more, and that is to largely focus on domestic challenges, largely focus on getting their economy properly balanced, continuing to deliver good livelihoods and positive prospects for its citizens, bringing them out of poverty, and dealing with a host of just major problems that they've got in China, from the environment to the social gaps that are and inequities that are growing, corruption obviously another big problem. But to do that, they need a relatively peaceful external environment, because by having those productive relationships externally, it not only prevents distractions from arising outside of China, but maintains those sorts of economic, trade, and investment relationships with its key partners that it needs to drive that progress it needs.
Now, it always intrigues me, people who've sort of lived and worked across all these different parts of the world and have this sort of advantage, a little window in, if you like, to these different dynamics. What about how the sort of European bloc fits into that? Do you think there are really still a great deal of, is there a lot of common interest between China, the US, and the European Union? Are there sufficient things to kind of hold all of those three together? How do you see Europe fitting in as well in that balance between, obviously, its traditional ally in the US and China? What's your take? You've sort of worked in Europe. You're now in Australia. You have such a good window in it. How do you see the three, if you like, the three corners of that triangle interacting?
Well, I've always wished for far more informed and active engagement on the part of Europe broadly, or the EU more specifically, in Asia. I mean, for reasons of history and other important ties, of course, Europe is obviously focused to its immediate periphery, as well as an excellent relationship with the United States. But that, I think, is a little short-sighted. I think Europe, in a host of ways across political, diplomatic, economic, even military angles, has an important contribution to make to the future stability of the Asian region. That's really where the common interests lie. And while, of course, Europe has enormous challenges within its own borders, not least economic and financial, it has a range of challenges on its immediate periphery, such as in its relations with Russia, and now increasingly in the Middle East. That should not lead to a Europe which is not seeing itself as an active and positive player in Asia as well. I think everyone benefits when that happens.
Bates, just finally, very briefly, I wanted to come back to Australia. Obviously, your new base now. It's been election season this very weekend. A great deal of sort of excitement. It's been a hotly contested. It's been a fairly vitriolic campaign at times. I just wonder what's the sort of dynamic between Australia and the US then? What's your take? Because some of these politicians, like I know Kevin Rudd, he has quite a sort of significant reputation. He's obviously invested a lot of his sort of energies in ensuring that he's a presence in the US and that he's someone who people in DC know and hopefully understand. How important is that balance politically, do you think, for the Australian sort of political candidates to establish themselves as players, in the US to build up a good, what effective working relationships with people, you know, on Capitol Hill there. Is that become increasingly important, do you think?
My sense, and having only been there a year or so, trying to follow what has been a really fun election season for a person like me to try to understand, domestically in Australia, obviously it's not good for your standing politically if for some reason you have a bad relationship with the United States. That's rarely the case. But at the same time, I don't think that you gain points necessarily as a politician in Australia if you're seen as close or somehow appreciated more than your opponent in Washington. I just don't think it counts for all that much to the Australian electorate. And one reason for that is probably that at the end of the day, there's not a lot of daylight, at least in terms of the U.S.-Australia relationship, the alliance. You know, as we would say in America, it's almost like motherhood and apple pie. There's just not that much daylight between the parties regarding their relationship with the United States. Everyone seems to be very, foursquare behind it, want to see it deepened, want to see it extended, made more intensive. And if the Australian voter is, for some reason, particularly interested in this question, well, I think they would find, in the case of Mr. Abbott and his team, that they have also done pretty well in terms of establishing good relationships in Washington. So there's not that big of a difference, and at the end of the day, I think is almost not a factor.
Exciting times indeed. Bateskill, thanks very much for going to speak to us on Monocle 24.
Thanks so much, Tom.
That was Dr. Bateskill talking to me a little earlier. We're going to be talking about London's hidden attractions right after this.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with Tom Edwards and me, Markus Hippi. Well, we are all familiar or a little over-familiar with the tourist maps of the world. In the modern age, even that tucked-away bar or untapped natural wonder can't escape the all-knowing eye of Google Maps. In a city like London, you'd be forgiven for thinking there is nothing left to discover.
But our final guest, the author John Rogers, has been travelling his home city, London, to find a hidden side of life. His new book, This Other London, Adventure in the Overlooked City, lifts the lid on the strange wonders of the suburbs and the rich history that contributes to the everyday, such as tales of the highwaymen of Hounslow Heath or London's industrial docklands that somehow doubled up as Vietnam in Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. He joins us now to tell us a bit more.
I'd like to start by asking you to tell us about the background of that book. Basically, the whole story starts in Asia in the 1990s.
It starts in 94 in Asia, that's right. And I was setting off on my big adventure and thought, I really wanted to break out. I'd been living in a squat in Hackney for a year and a half, 2 years after graduating from Polytechnic. And this is early 90s London, and it was quite hard. So I thought, I'd read On the Road by Jack Kerouac. I heard about kicks, on getting your kicks on the road. And I thought, yes, this is it. So I set off. And pretty soon headed up into the Golden Triangle to do my jungle trekking. And I was, rode an elephant. It was amazing, riding an elephant over the crest of a mountain. It was amazing. And we arrived in this little village. I thought, oh, this is it, This is little kids running around in sort of like loincloths sort of thing. And this is going to the hut, where this guy's preparing an opium pipe. And it's like, oh, my God, I was so excited. And it was really gloomy. I just sat down. And there was this other girl already in the hut. And she looked like a traveller, but she was, you can tell when you do the backpacking thing, there'll be a lot of people who can relate to this, particularly if you've ever been somewhere like Bangkok. The streets are littered with the various grades of backpacker, and the really experienced ones have a certain look to them, don't they? And they sort of collect that string that gets tied around your wrist in India. They call it holy string, and then charge you an unholy amount of money for it. And she had so much holy string on her wrist. I thought, wow, this woman's really a wise woman on the road. And so she was telling me all this stuff. I was writing down these addresses. This guy would smuggle me into Burma, because you couldn't go into Burma then, and he had a gun. He'd lend you one for yourself as well. And it turned out, anyway, after a bit of conversation, she lived next door to my sister in Maidenhead. She was just like on a sort of like a sabbatical. She was an accountant, And I just thought, oh my God, I've come 8,000 miles to sit with exactly the kind of person I would sit with at home, When I eventually went on a very circuitous route to get back to London, and then started a family and found I couldn't really, obviously, do those kind of things anymore. But also I realised that I didn't know London at all. I'd lived in London on and off for 20 years. And I'd made a radio show about London, exploring London as well. But when I bought this old 1975 Atlas of Greater London, I like to read A to Z's like you'd read a book. And I was flicking through it. And I just kept flicking through. The Master Atlas of Greater London, by the way, that's the one you want rather than the little A to Z's. And because it's got everything in it. And I was flicking through and I just didn't know any of these places. And they were far more exotic to me than the Golden Triangle, you know. So I set out to explore London in the way I'd set out to explore Southeast Asia and India and Australia. And to approach it with the same mentality. And I had the same experience. In fact, actually, the experiences I had were more profound simply because they were that much closer to home and embedded within the supposedly familiar.
So, I mean, how well concealed then are they? Because if you've got things like the Golden Triangle, it's so evocative, it paints a picture of a place in such a sort of intriguing and exciting way. So a lot of Londoners' ears, something like the Haringey Ladder might sound rather more prosaic. But in fact, as you said, there are those delights. How sort of difficult is it to actually uncover them? Or is it surprisingly easy?
There is a methodology and it's also about mentality. And I think one inspires the other. I think simply what you have to do, the first instance, you have to walk. You don't get the bus, you don't get the tube, you don't get a taxi, you don't cycle. You have to walk. If you start walking, even if you're walking along and you're worried about something that's happened at work, or have you fed the dog, or, you know, did you lock the door, and, you know, have you got enough water in your bag? Eventually you get into a certain state of mind where things start to reveal themselves. Now, obviously, a little bit of research helps a little bit. I mean, this book, obviously, so if you take my book with you, then things do reveal themselves. A lot of the things I've written about in this book, actually, are not necessarily visible, actually. I mean, they're occluded within the fabric of the built environment. Some of them are buildings, but a good percentage of them actually are within the fabric of the architecture, if you like.
You have discovered so many things in this book. It's actually quite funny that Tom just mentioned one place, Haringey Ladder. That's actually where I started my life in London.
Ah.
And, well,
see the connections. Aren't they amazing?
Connections, and I've never mentioned that to him. Tom's been living in London pretty much all of his life, I assume, whereas I've moved here 2 years ago, and I think I didn't recognise any of the places in the book. Did you recognise any, Tom?
Absolutely, and there were particular things that struck me, like, you know, the enduring appeal of pie, mash and liquor. And I wondered, things like the pie and mash shops, and there's so many of them that are still here, they're almost unchanged. I wonder, why do you think that maybe London isn't actually that good at selling some of those aspects of itself? Because I don't think it's on tourist hit lists, but when you go to other European cities all around the world, people talk about these interesting little cultural anomalies, amazing places that have all these secrets. Are we not very good at selling those to the rest of the world? Or do you think people just don't know about them?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think David Beckham did more for pie and mash than anybody's ever done, hasn't it? When he went for a pie and mash. Where I live now and live for a number of years now, in Leytonstone, that's where Beckham's from, you know, and that part, not that pie and mash shop, actually, he went to one in Chingford. But there is a very good pie and mash shop in Leytonstone. I think it's one of the things I set out to explore in the book. It was to highlight these places. If I were to be, the top thing I would say is, these are the places where people live. These are the work-a-day places. These are the places where ordinary Londoners live. And I think there's probably an agenda in promoting the places that are attached to money and wealth. And I think we like to put down, or certainly the media, the traditional media, like to put down places like Lewisham. I mean, South London only crops up on the BBC website when there's been a murder. If you went there now to the BBC London website, it'll just be about crime. And certainly anything south of the river is just crime. So you would think there was nothing to see south of the river.
John, obviously we do have listeners around the world, and just to give them an idea of what you've actually discovered and what everything we have in London, what have been the places you've been most excited about, things you've discovered during your trekkings?
There are so many. In terms of tangible architecture, which I think if you're a tourist and you come into London, you know, by all means do go to Westminster Abbey. It is incredible. By all means do go to St Paul's Cathedral. It is incredible. But then after that, go to Lanay Abbey in Abbey Wood, which is near Thamesmead Estate. And it's, you know, it's astonishing. It's like, for me, it's like it was like going to Borobudur, you know, in Indonesia. It's incredible. And it's like, it's the ruins of a large Augustinian abbey. And they built it, you know, the idea of a monk is monos, meaning alone or solitary. And it's a plateau on the edge of a very high hill in South London. And it sits on a bend in the river. So you've got views east and west along the river. From the other side of the hill, you can see the sea. It must be the only place in London, Belvedere, where you can see and smell the sea. It's incredible. And then on the other side of Belvedere, you drop down the hill. And if you're interested in, you know, the shape of a city, like when you go to Sydney, the topography of Sydney is unavoidable, isn't it? You know, it's built around a harbour. Everyone knows that. If you go to Edinburgh, it's astonishing in terms of, you know, you can't avoid, you know, the rock in the middle of Edinburgh and the, you know, all the amazing topography of Edinburgh. In London, people don't talk about it as much. But when you walk from Belvedere, you come off that hill and you drop into Erith, which could be pronounced Erith or Erith. You slice through the geology of the Thames Valley. You see a cross-section, an enormous cross-section of it. You see all the strata of rock. And you just don't get that anywhere else in London, really. There's an ancient trackway as well, which is another, you could walk along the Silk Road, or you get a bus tour along the Silk Road through Asia, but you could walk from Sudbury Hill to Brentford along an ancient British trackway that, for a lot of the way, is you feel like you are in the Neolithic. Do you know what? My feeling is people do feel very proud and connected to where they live. It's just they don't really feel allowed to demonstrate that if you live somewhere unfashionable. If you live in Mayfair and someone says, what's Mayfair? Oh, it's lovely, and it is lovely, of course. But if you live in Lewisham and someone says, what's Lewisham like? They're probably inclined to go, but if you went, well, I think it's one of the best places in London, they go, yeah, well, actually, I agree with you there, And I think it needs more celebration. I think we need to celebrate these areas more, and we need to sort of encourage people to take pride in those things, take pride in it publicly, take pride.
I still need to ask, before we let you go, that when you were going for these walks with your Stellakan and Samosa, as the case quite often seemed to be, did you ever manage to persuade your family to join you?
Right at the very end, it's funny because I was nearly running out of time because I had a time period to do the book in, and I kept asking them. I've got two children. At that age, just before they say I was 9 and 7 years old, and they're going, you must be joking, we're not coming with you. And because they've got an Xbox and they've got great Lego, so it was impossible, really. And then finally I said to them, will you come on a walk with me? And the little one said, yeah, I'll go on a walk with you to South Park. And this is the South Park of the animated TV show. And I said, well, that's in Colorado. And he went, yeah. I went, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll take you on a walk to South Park. I didn't mention Colorado, actually. I knew he knew it was Colorado. So he said, will you go take me to South Park? I went, yes, I'll take you to South Park. He said, right, you sure? I went, yeah. So let's shake on it. So the elder one's there, and he said, hang on a moment. If you're going to South Park, I'm coming. So he joins in. We shake on it because that's South Park in Ilford. And Ilford's about 6 miles away from where we live. So we did, and they stuck to it, and we walked. We took some little South Park figures that they'd had, which is how they first became aware of the show. And they had this, we took the figures back to their true spiritual home, which is a park on the other side of Ilford, which is love, which is a fantastic walk. Highly recommend Wanstead Flats. That's a great walk. Wanstead Flats is the ruins of an old palace, which was once one of the biggest palaces in Europe. And all that's left now is a coach house.
It's amazing stuff, John. I just wondered, in your introduction, you talk about some of your objectives for the book, how you were influenced, I think you touched on it earlier, with the sort of the beat writers in America trekking out into the country to find this mysterious thing, to find it, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Looking at the other London, those stories, they're so sort of intoxicating. It makes me want to set out on my own right now. But did you find that? Did you find it when you were hitting the streets?
I would never want to say I found it. I certainly found an awful lot more than I thought I would, for sure. And it's an ongoing journey. It doesn't end there. There's 10 chapters in here, 10 walks. And really, you could walk London for your entire life. And I don't think you'd ever find it. But you're certainly on every walk, I found something quite deep and profound. More profound than actually I found when I went backpacking around the world, to be honest.
John Rogers, thanks very much for joining Marcus and myself here on the Monocle Weekly. And best of luck with the book. Well, that is about all for this edition. It's the 218th, hard to believe, of the Monocle Weekly. Any particular highlights for you, Marcus Zippy?
I have to say that this hour actually went really quickly. I was really inspired by this last interview we did with John Rogers about London and stuff that I haven't discovered and, well, you hadn't discovered either. Even you've been living here for the whole of your life.
I've been here all my life, but there's things I was learning from him. It's fascinating. I agree with what you said. I'm going to get a can of high-strength continental lager and a couple of international snacks and take to the streets of London.
But Tom, I am the food expert over here on this channel, pretty much. I've got my own food program and all, so I can't be walking around carrying a can of Stella and a Samosa. I have to find something more high-end.
Why don't you just brown bag it or pour it into a champagne bottle, perhaps?
That is clever. That sounds really good. I may actually do that.
I'm full of bright ideas.
What else can you suggest?
Well, the Samosa you could perhaps secrete in a larger foodstuff.
Oh, yes.
Hollow out something, maybe a baguette.
And anyway, street food is really trendy at the moment, so I can, Exactly. Yeah, I have a thing.
Exactly, I'll fit like a glove.
That sounds amazing, but there's definitely lots of... It's actually amazing how London, as you said earlier, how London hasn't realised to point out all the other stuff there is over here. I've got this history of coming to London as a tourist for who knows how many times, and I've always been going the same route from Westminster to Soho.
Well, but the secrets are out, though, now. Now we've been hearing from John Rogers. London's probably going to start rebranding itself, I imagine.
I think I still want to go myself as well, to go for those, look for those places where Full Metal Jacket was filmed. I know there's not that much left over there, but still, just to be there.
Sure, you could pick through the rubble.
Yeah.
They'd let you do that. Just the name Marcus Hippie carries a lot of weight in this town, from what I understand.
Oh, what have you heard?
Well, it's best not to go into it on a live broadcast.
Let's talk about that after this edition of the Monocle Weekly. Indeed, it was number 280.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall with help from Daphne Denis. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Fischeco, and our studio managers were Claire Urban and Jack Phillips. We'll be back. Well, perhaps you and I won't be, Marcus, but the show will be. But for now... From me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Marcus Hippie.
It's goodbye.
Goodbye.